Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests, which shut down the World Trade Organization summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city, we're gonna shake the gates of hell. And I will tell them, we will tell them. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. That our sunlight is not for franchise, and wish the bastards drop down dead. Next time you see me, I may be smiling. Ciao, bella, ciao, bella, ciao, ciao, ciao. I'll be in prison or on the TV.
Week's Indie Media Radio London show. We've got a big crowd here today, unlike last week, so hello everybody.
I'd like to say thank you for Paul for a really nice show earlier.
And
this week's show, we've got lots of things. What have we got, Penny?
We've got stories from the case in New York, which rules that the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay is going to be ruled illegal. But the problem is, how do you get inside to speak to the people to let them know that they can actually sue their interrogators? We've got stories from the abuse of a Cyprus IMC-er investigated, and lots of news from Bolivia and various pickets and all our up-and-coming protests from across the UK. So, off you go. First track now. What should we do?
Yeah, go on.
Play it.
Go on,
Police
what
and
is
Thieves,
it?
Junior Merton.
And peace.
first thing up today is a ruling on the 28th of June outlined that the United States cannot order the indefinite detention of Guantanamo detainees without due process, and that the detainees have the right to challenge the legitimacy of their detention in court, according to the US Constitution and international law. The Center for Constitutional Rights mounted the legal challenge, which brought the plight of those detained to the Supreme Court of the United States. For those currently detained without trial, the ruling is an important legal victory. The ruling is also a victory for the many international campaigns against the conditions at Guantanamo and against the war on terror, which the continued detentions at Guantanamo are a part. We got audio from this, about this, in today's outro, along with a piece of audio from Schnooze about Nine Ladies, but that'll be at the very end of the show.
Last week, Indie Media Cyprus learned that the US Central Intelligence Agency directed the US Embassy in Cyprus to instruct the Criminal Investigation Division of the police in Cyprus to investigate an IMC member who is politically active both in the US and in Cyprus. Petros Edvokas had been living in Portland, Oregon recently, and is one of the volunteers and journalists for Cyprus Indie Media. The intelligence investigation is based on an article he wrote for Cyprus Indie Media documenting some of the manipulations by the US intelligence operation using the United Nations to influence the recent referendum in Cyprus on the Annan Plan, the UN's plan to reunite the island in an apartheid-style arrangement. The article has just been republished by Indie Media due to renewed interest by newspapers and other political organisations. Indie Media is trying to publicise this and let people know what's going on. The investigators questioned the author's parents and wanted them to state in writing whether he constitutes a threat to US interests. The implications of this episode go beyond mere harassment of an activist's and journalist's family. This case illustrates the US policy of interference in even the most mundane internal affairs of other countries, and it shows the degree to which the local authorities jump when the US says to. Full details can be found at cyprus.indymedia.org.
Last October, tens of thousands of poor indigenous Bolivians blocked highways and faced off with heavily armed soldiers in protest at a controversial plan to export natural gas to the United States through Chile. Under this enormous amount of vocal people pressure, which resulted in 59 deaths from the Bolivian military forces, the then vice president and current Bolivian president, Carlos Mesa, made sweet promises of returning the gas, the latest of the country's natural resources to be plundered by foreign investors to the people. Yesterday was set aside as a day for the people to vote on such a promise, but instead the Mesa government has offered the people little more than a token way to decide between different versions of exploitation. Record numbers of Bolivian citizens protested this insult by purposely spoiling and voiding their votes, the only way to legally abstain from the mandatory vote. Outrage over transnational privatisation of gas continues to escalate, and the tension in Bolivia is tangible. The following report was written by Jennifer Whitney on the 18th of July and will be found on full on indymedia.org. That's the global site.
Bolivia, South America's poorest country, has long had its wealth plundered by foreigners. First, it was the realisation by the Spanish in the 16th century that a small hill in the southeast of the country was comprised almost entirely of silver. For two centuries, the wealth extracted from Cerro Rico in Potosi was, according to Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, the primary nourishment of the capitalist development of Europe. Next, it was Salt Peter, desperately needed as fertilizer for exhausted European soil and plundered by the English. Then, during the Second World War, Bolivia's tin was mined and sold at approximately 10 times less than market price, leading to massive strikes and massacres of the workers, who were only demanding to be paid a living wage. Now, the world wants Bolivia's gas, the second largest reserve in Latin America. But Bolivians are sick of watching the wealth of their nation stolen from underneath their feet. Last October, nationwide popular resistance to a export scheme which would have sent gas to California resulted in bloodbath. Around 100 were killed and 400 more injured, but in the end the people prevailed as the detested president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Losta, commonly called Goni, resigned from office, fleeing the presidential palace in a helicopter and then heading to Miami, the traditional refuge of right-wing Latin American scoundrels.
This was the third time in 3 years that such dramatic uprisings had occurred in Bolivia. The first was in 2000, when the people of Cochabamba successfully reclaimed their water from a subsidiary of California engineering giant Bechtel, which had raised rates by anywhere from 200% to 400% and was charging people for wells, rainwater catchment and irrigation systems they had constructed themselves at their own expense. 3 years on, the water continues to be successfully run by the people. The second occurred in February of last year when popular protests forced the government to roll back IMF-imposed taxes and cuts to social benefits. The protests resulted in a few demands by the campesinos: the suspension of cocoa eradication, the total rejection of the FTAA, an end to privatisation and nationalisation of gas. People are able to vote for or against the repeal of the current law pertaining to gas, passed by Goni, rebranding and restructuring of the privatised state oil company, the use of gas as a strategy towards regaining territory lost to Chile over 100 years ago, and a vague idea about how money gained from exportation might be spent. Nothing close to nationalisation, nothing close to annulling the 78 contracts with transnationals which already exist, nothing close to meeting the demands of the people. In fact, the government has already signed an agreement with the IMF, committing to having a clear strategy in place by October 31st of this year.
Guaranteeing exportation of gas. Today's referendum is little more than an instrument towards fulfilling that commitment. In Bolivia, voting is obligatory and abstention is punishable by a fine equivalent to about a month's salary. Not to mention that without the proper marks on one's paperwork means that one cannot conduct banking transactions, travel, among other serious inconveniences. Even so, many tables are reporting record high levels of abstention by people who can scarce afford to pay these fines. In Sacata, a region of El Alto, blockades of burning tyres were built last night, are still smouldering at 6:30 this morning, despite a light drift of snow which had fallen the night before. Few people were on the street, but it was silent. When the journalist returned several hours later, a crowd of about 200 people had gathered. The atmosphere among them was calm, despite them having driven out several journalists half an hour prior to their arrival. The people, for the most part, quite friendly and eager to share their perspective. Sounds like the situation the US is currently faced with. As the Indy Media journalist prepared to post this, the numbers are coming in. At that point, all five questions are passing, an incredible vote of confidence in Mesa's government. Or is it? With 40% abstention and 15% of ballots spoiled, thus either blank or void, it seems that only about 45% of the electorate voted at all. That is to say, about 23% of Bolivians' population. Not much on which to base one's legitimacy. Whatever the government decides to do with the final figures, the people have spoken very clearly. This referendum doesn't come close to their primary demand, nationalisation of their gas, which they have been clearly stating for a long time. They are well aware that the referendum is being used as a tool to legitimise the government and as an attempt to pacify them, to get them to return to their homes and their routines. Yet these are people who are quite adept at creating true participatory democracy. This spectacle of a referendum, this dictatorship democracy, is unlikely to appease them. As Marco from Sankata put it, there are going to be actions in the future which will be much stronger and more radical than those of October. We will not stop until we get nationalisation. For more details on this, see BoliviaIndyMedia.org. And now we're going to play The Blues Explosion by John Spencer. We'll be right back.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Right now, I got to tell you about the fabulous, most groovy Bell Bottoms. Bell Bottoms.
Against peace movement in Japan. Three anti-war activists affiliated to World Peace Now, WPN, were brutally harassed by Japanese police officers who detained them for a week and they were later released after the July the 4th Vote for Peace parade rally that was held in Shibuya district. According to reports, during the peaceful parade organised by WPN, urging the Japanese government to withdraw its SDF in Iraq, police officers started to violently provoke the protesters by pushing them back and force them to walk faster. Then the police force suddenly got a full Nelson on two participants and arrested them without warning, Nananshi Solidarity Collective added. After the incident, some of the WPN contingent immediately held an indignation rally in front of the Shibuya police station to demand the release of their comrades, but the activists were only assaulted again by the police and grabbed one more innocent detainee.
Okay, I don't know if anyone's seen advertised on the tube, but the Farnborough Air Show is going on, and we featured it last week on the show where we mentioned the activities of various arms dealers that were involved. Well, last night was the Farnborough Arms Dealer Arms Sponsor Dinner. And I've got here somebody that was protesting at that dinner, and she was harassed quite horribly. Are you there? Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So can you tell me, what were you trying to do outside this Farnborough dinner, and where were you?
It was at the Grosvenor House Hotel on Park Lane, and none of us went down there. We just wanted to really have a presence there and sort of say, because the arms dealers have their big dinner, that they couldn't get away with having their dinner without sort of being noticed, really, and that we'd follow them wherever they go, especially when they're kind of eating their expensive food while doing a business that kills people.
What? So why do you think it's important to follow these arms dealers everywhere they go?
So they don't feel comfortable.
So, and what happened outside this protest? Would you say it was a successful protest?
In many ways it was, I think. I've heard unconfirmed reports that two people got inside at some point, but I don't know the details of that. And there was quite a few people outside. A number of us walked down the road towards the hotel to begin with, and we were quickly surrounded by police and pushed into a pen. As I was being pushed into the pen, my bag was grabbed from behind, and I was sort of forcibly detained to do a stop and search. And lots of people protested about it. And they
On what grounds were you away. Stopped and searched?
Well, I was stopped and searched under case for articles to commit criminal damage. But according to my search record, I was stopped and searched under the Terrorism Act as part of a pre-planned police operation.
And there's no way that you could be viewed as a terrorist. What was in your bag?
I had sunglasses, a book, and some dolls covered in fake blood, and a wallet, I think.
Were you charged?
I was charged with... I was eventually arrested for these dolls, but originally they were going to let me go for them, and then they decided later they were going to arrest me for them. And they charged me with going equipped to commit criminal damage for having dolls that were obviously for a piece of street theatre.
How could you commit criminal damage with some dolls? I have to ask this question.
You know what? I'm not entirely sure. I've been trying to figure this one out all night. Because if I had, I wanted to... I mean, they said that I was going to throw the dolls at the delegates and thereby stain their clothes with blood from the dolls. However, if I'd wanted to, I'd have had paint bombs or something like that if I really wanted to get paint over delegates.
Which, of course, you wouldn't want to do.
I wouldn't want to do that at all, but had I wanted to, that would be the way to do it, not with a doll.
And so what were you going to do with these dolls?
Well, George Robertson was there last night. And
who's George Robertson?
He's the ex-chief of NATO. And he was there to be awarded a ceremonial sword. And this sword was for outstanding contribution to Anglo-American aerospace relations. So I brought these dolls with me to sort of as an alternative award.
To
show sort of like really what this sort of fantastic partnership does.
And that really is kind of what do you think that fantastic partnership does?
I think so, yes. Well, it causes death and destruction and misery.
So what do you think about the symbolism of handing someone a sword? Do you think that's a bit odd?
Well, I think it's very odd, really. It kind of says a lot, really, doesn't it? I think it speaks for itself.
And when you were arrested, would you say you were arrested legally? How did your arrest actually feel? Because I'm quite concerned that I know of many people that go on protests and they get arrested and the police stand there and they say, what should we charge them with? A Section 4, what an assault? And they kind of tick off the minor offences they could pull someone into a police station for. Would you say that your arrest was legal?
Not at all. Basically what happened was I was searched and they found these dolls. And they said initially that they were going to keep the dolls to prevent the breach of the peace. They weren't going to arrest me, but they were going to keep them because they thought I might commit a breach of the peace with them. Now, I pointed out to them that it wasn't actually possible to take someone's property to prevent a breach of the peace. If you search someone, you either give them their property back, or if there's something they're not supposed to have, you have to arrest them for an offence. You can't just randomly take their property and say you can have it back later. So I was arguing with them for a long time about this. And they threatened to arrest me if I didn't stop arguing. And so eventually I backed away because I really didn't actually want to get arrested. And as I was sort of turning away, I saw a friend of mine being sort of tackled to the ground by some police. So I went over to find out what was happening. And then lots of cops jumped on top of me. And initially they said they wanted to arrest me for breach of the peace. And there was a woman there from the Ford intelligence team. And she said, no. Do her for the dolls and for Public Order Act. So that's what I was done for.
So that's pretty much arbitrary policing, really, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And so what do you think you can do about that?
Well, at the moment I've got a court case to fight. And once that's over, I can think about sort of trying to bring civil action against the police for harassment generally. because this sort of thing happens all the time. It's not like a one-off sort of situation. It's one of these things that if you go on a protest, you start expecting these things to happen. And in this country now, you've got to a point where you can't go on a protest without expecting to be pushed around, without having your bag searched, without running the risk of arrest for really stupid offences.
And do you think, people should stop protesting because of this harassment?
No, I think people have to do more. And I think the cops feel they're winning at the moment because less people are coming out on things at the moment. And I think people have to get out there again and again and again and show that we won't be subdued by this sort of harassment and that we can fight it and we can win. And I think the more cases we can bring against the cops, the better. Because ultimately, you know, if it costs some money, it will help. And I think we have to try and do something.
And do you think that it's become more difficult to protest since 9/11?
I think so, definitely. I think the government have used that as a real excuse to bring in piece after piece of oppressive legislation. I don't think there's any way that if it hadn't been for 9/11 that protesters would have been justifiably searched under the Terrorism Act. I think they'd have found that extremely difficult. And there's been so many changes in the law recently that have just tightened one thing up after another. And they're just using them on protesters slowly and slowly and slowly. For example, there's been talk recently of antisocial behaviour orders being used on protesters to keep them away from sort of military bases and stuff like that. And as far as I know, it hasn't been happened yet, but it's being threatened, and it's not going to be long before they start doing those kind of things. There's the injunctions that have happened recently, which are supposed to protect people from harassment, that big companies like Bayer are using against activists. So again, it's one thing after another that's eroding people's right to protest with one piece of repressive legislation after another.
Okay, so thank you very much. And if anyone has any concerns about how they've been treated on a protest, please report your kind of experiences to Indie Media on indiemedia.co.uk. And if you feel really harassed, get in contact with a lawyer or get in contact with Liberty. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, in every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberation from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done, for such invaluable assistance. After we torture our prisoners, you won't have to worry about tyrants and bullies. Now that you have sovereignty, you can hold your head high, kiss Saddam goodbye, say hello to democracy. After we torture our prisoners, after we torture our prisoners.
51 Filipino troops completely pulled out of Iraq yesterday following the successful anti-war campaign in the Philippines to save the life of Angelo de la Cruz, who was held captive by the Iraqi Liberation Army. According to information gathered by corporate media, Angelo, a Filipino truck driver held hostage by Iraqi militants, was released by his captors shortly after the Filipino troops' pullout. This was confirmed by President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo yesterday in a press briefing, announcing that Angelo had already been handed over by the Iraqi rebels to the Philippine embassy after she agreed to the rebels' demand. The release of Angelo and the pullout of troops received a warm yet critical welcome from the anti-war movement against the president's response to the hostage crisis. A statement by the Iraqi Solidarity Campaign, a coalition of peace and justice groups, said, "Our gratitude, however, is not reserved for the president. It was her, after all, who, by supporting an illegal war and occupation, put Angelo de la Cruz in harm's way. It was her who, by holding the people's welfare hostage to her and the United States' interest, held the life of Angelo in her hand. No, we cannot thank the president for putting aside the knife that she herself had held so close to Angelo's neck." See manila.indymedia.org for more details.
And now a story from a bit closer to home. The Australian consular offices picketed. Early last week, activists occupied the Australian consular offices in Manchester in a protest against old-growth logging in Australia. After seeing the destruction caused by logging in areas such as Victoria and Tasmania, activists in the UK decided to target the Australian consulate. Australia is home to some amazing areas of old-growth rainforest, which have remained relatively unaltered by humans for thousands of years. Now it is being felled at an alarming rate, even in supposedly protected areas. In Tasmania, 90% of native forest felled is converted into wood chip for the Asian paper industry. Thus, priceless ancient forest is trashed and sold for $15, which is less than £6 per tonne to make cardboard. There are huge campaigns against this logging in Australia involving direct action blockades, tree sits, marches and rallies, lobbying and more.
Coca-Cola picket anniversary. 1 year today, Sinel Train Al, the Colombian Food and Drink Workers Union, called for a boycott of Coca-Cola and all its products in response to a brutal policy of terror and repression that Coca-Cola had unleashed against their own workers in Colombia. Between 1994 to 1998, Coca-Cola workers and Sinel Train Al union leaders have been assassinated by paramilitaries who the evidence suggests were hired by Colombia's Coca-Cola management. Hundreds of other workers and union members have been imprisoned, tortured, threatened, disappeared, or forced into exile. The first year of the boycott has been a success in many ways. Individuals and social and trade union organisations all around the world have pledged their support of the boycott, including the Scottish Socialist Party and Unison in the UK. However, Coca-Cola have refused to abandon their hard line, have refused to negotiate with Sinel Trainor, and the repression against the workers at the factory has continued since the boycott started on the 22nd of July 2003. Coke workers in Colombia had to go on hunger strike to fight mass sackings. Union Vice President Juan Carlos Galvez was injured in an assassination attempt. Union leader Luis Eduardo Garcia's son escaped from a paramilitary kidnapped. Four members of union leader El Frain Guerrero's family were slaughtered in their beds by paramilitaries. Coke have launched their seventh libel case against a Sinel Trainor leader. When the union launched the boycott campaign, they knew there would be a price to pay and are relying on international support and solidarity to see them through to the end of their fight for justice. The picket takes place tomorrow, Thursday, July the 22nd, between 5 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. at Coca-Cola, Great Britain and Ireland, 1 Queen Caroline Street, Hammersmith, London W6, and it's just outside Hammersmith Tube.
There's a story on the front pages of newspapers worldwide, well, everywhere except the UK and the US, both countries which have recently released reports that intelligence over the war on Iraq was flawed and the mainstream media outlets didn't attempt to follow up on what they were being spoon-fed by the media. Williams Rivers Pitt posted that the biggest story of the Iraq War is not about missing weapons of mass destruction or about deep cover CIA officers getting their covers blown by vengeful White House agents, or even about 896 dead American soldiers. These have been covered to one degree or another and then summarily dismissed by the American mainstream news media. The biggest story of the Iraq War has not enjoyed any coverage in America, though it has been exploding across the international news media for several weeks now. The biggest story of the Iraq War is about the torture of Iraqi children. A German TV magazine called Report Mainz recently aired accusations from the International Red Cross to the effect that over 100 children are imprisoned in the US-controlled detention centres, including Abu Ghraib. Between January and May of this year, the Red Cross have registered 107 children during 19 visits in 6 different detention locations. Red Cross representative Florian Westphal says the report also outlined eyewitness testimony of the abuse of these children. Staff Sergeant Samuel Provence, who was stationed at Abu Ghraib, said that interrogating officers had gotten their hands on a 15 or 16-year-old girl. Military police only stopped the interrogation when the girl was half undressed. A separate incident described a 16-year-old being soaked with water, driven through the cold, smeared with mud, and then presented before his weeping father, who was also a prisoner.
Pretty bad.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, another thing about the US. The US, United States government has for the third year withheld millions of dollars from the United Nations Population Fund because it says the organization supports forced abortions in China. The fund disputes the US claim and says the money is urgently needed to slow the spread of HIV. It also says it could prevent 2 million unintended pregnancies, 800,000 abortions, and the deaths of more than 5,000 mothers and young children worldwide. The funders slammed the move as an example of President Bush's focus on abstinence as the main weapon against HIV and AIDS.
A humanitarian group says it has documents proving the Sudanese government supported the Arab militias which have devastated Dafar province and driven a million ethnic Africans from their homes. Human Rights Watch says the papers show that the Qataram regime instructed its forces to support the militias, to overlook their crimes and to stop displaced people returning to their villages. The papers are in Arabic and call for all personnel, ammunition and other supplies to be delivered to the fighters. The Sudanese government has reportedly denied any association with the militias.
The famine-related disease, kwashiorkor, is on the increase in the capital of Zimbabwe. The illness is caused by a lack of protein and causes a bloated stomach and spindly limbs and is fatal if not treated. Doctors in Harare say cases of kwashiorkor have already risen by 10% on last year and almost all of them are among children under 5. President Mugabe's government insists that there are no food shortages in Zimbabwe and has rejected food aid.
Upcoming events around London. Tomorrow, Thursday, the 22nd of July, the Refugee Project are holding a public meeting. The Refugee Project evolved out of the work of the Lisu Dam campaign, which was formed in 1999 to oppose any British government financial support for a British company to build the proposed Lisu Dam in southeastern Turkey. If built, the dam would affect 78,000 people, the majority of them Kurdish, and heighten the risk of water wars with downstream countries, which just happen to be Iran. The Lisu Dam campaign, a coalition of rights and environmental organisation and Kurdish refugees in Britain, argued that £200 million of British taxpayers' money should not support the British construction firm Balfour Beatty, contracted by the Turkish government to build the dam. As a result of its campaign, Balfour Beatty withdrew from the dam project in November 2001. That's the Refugee Project monthly meeting, which is 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, and on Friday the 23rd, the London Anarchist Forum is hosting a talk by Gottfried Hoy. I don't know how to say that. That's at 8 p.m. Conway Hall, Red Lion Square. That's free. And for many more up-and-coming events all over the country, you can check out Schnooze at www.schnooze.org. indiemedia.org.uk and, of course, indiemedia.org.uk. I think we've just about come to the end of our show now, and we're going out with that report about Guantanamo Bay. I said it! Hooray! We're going out with that report, and as Andrew here said earlier, we're going to finish with the Nine Ladies report. The Nine Ladies is the stones that people are fighting to save from tarmac, I believe. Okay, goodbye.
We'll see you all next week.
We'll hopefully you'll all be listening. Okay. Ciao, Bella.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
June 28, 2004, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the U.S. government cannot order the indefinite detention of hundreds of so-called enemy combatants from throughout the world at Guantanamo Bay without due legal process. Further, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the detainees have the right to challenge the legality of their detention according to the U.S. Constitution and international law. For those currently detained without trial at Guantanamo Bay, the ruling is an important legal victory and is also a victory for the many international campaigns against the conditions at Guantanamo and against the so-called War on Terror, which the continued detentions at Guantanamo are a part of. Listen to an interview with Shane Accardo, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. The interview focuses on the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling concerning Guantanamo Bay.
Well, we won the case, although the detainees themselves may not know it, and I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of the follow-up to the case. But let me give you some background to the case. As you know, there are some 600-plus people, all citizens of countries other than the U.S., detained in Guantanamo, including some Canadians. But there are people who were detained not just in Afghanistan, but hundreds detained in Pakistan, some in Gambia, some in Bosnia. We have one client who was an Australian citizen who was detained in Pakistan, sent to Egypt, and then sent by the Egyptian authorities to Afghanistan and thence to Guantanamo. So it's really kind of an international dumping ground for anyone the U.S. suspects of terrorism. And so this is a very convenient thing for the government to have in its arsenal. And the courts, when we challenged the detentions first 2 years ago, the lower federal court said that there was no right of access whatsoever to federal courts for non-U.S. citizens who were detained outside of the territory of the United States, even though they were under the complete control of the United States. So there were a lot of technical issues to be resolved in this case about the status of Guantanamo. It's, as you know, leased perpetually from Cuba under a lease that was signed when Cuba was basically a colony of the U.S. after the Spanish-American War. And the lower courts had said that because Cuba essentially retains title to the sovereignty over the base, even though the U.S. has complete control and has it rented forever, that U.S. courts can't really touch anything that goes on there. And the Supreme Court, I think maybe not surprisingly in retrospect, said, no, this isn't the case. You can't have a little zone without law. I think one of the surprising things about the case was the margin that we won by. We got 6 votes and only 3 against. I think very pleasingly, the court left the merits of the kind of review that detainees there would get open. They said, you know, just that you have access to federal courts, but they didn't say, you know, that, well, it's a very limited access or we're only going to look at the facts of whether or not you were captured on the battlefield or something like that. They said, let the lower courts work this out.
Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of Guantanamo Bay, the continued indefinite detention of people from throughout the world, as you mentioned, has sparked international criticism of the United States. Now, do you feel that the decision which took place in the Supreme Court was in some way influenced by the fact that countries, even governments from throughout the world, have been criticizing the United States military policies at Guantanamo?
Sure. I think that's certainly been some part of it. There are a number of justices who, in all sorts of other decisions over the last few years, have increasingly cited to international law and to the practices of other countries with respect to international law, have cited to Supreme Court decisions from other nations. And so that's a nice trend. I think in the United States, we had a long period where civil rights were sort of something that was enforced by federal courts against state governments. And now I think we see a body of transnational law emerging, international law, that can trump what federal governments want to do when they are violating people's rights. But more so than even that, I think the Abu Ghraib prison scandal really brought home to the justices the fact that when you let the executive do whatever it wants, when you let the president and the military do whatever they want to prisoners without any oversight from a disinterested judiciary, then you get these kind of abuses. And that's something that we've seen throughout history from totalitarian governments, and it shouldn't surprise us at all that it's happened in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. Of course, the Abu Ghraib interrogation tactics were basically policies put in place by people who had developed them, in particular General Miller, in Guantanamo for interrogations of Guantanamo detainees. And all that stuff became public a week or two after the argument of the case in April. And I think that must have had a great impact on the justices.
Maybe then could you speak about how you view this decision and also the intensive work which the Center for Constitutional Rights has been doing around the situation at Guantanamo? How do you view this within the context of a larger critique or a social movement against acts of U.S. military aggression around the world? How do you see your work, the Supreme Court decision, as part of a larger social movement?
It's a huge victory against this sort of move to militarize aspects of domestic society, that we've seen in all sorts of ways. Most troublingly with the cases involving even U.S. citizens detained here in the United States who are being held in military custody. And I think this shows that the Supreme Court, as it has for the most part throughout its history, is very, very skeptical about efforts of the executive to assert that we're in such a crisis that militarization of the criminal justice system is necessary. So that's, I think, is the basic lesson that I'm taking away from this case, and it's very encouraging. Although obviously we're sort of fighting a rearguard action here. We're fighting a tremendously reactionary set of actions by the government. But it's nice to know that the courts, even very conservative courts at this time in the U.S., are on our side.
You have been listening to an interview with Shayna Carrido, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. The interview focused on the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling concerning the indefinite detention of hundreds of so-called enemy combatants from throughout the world at Guantanamo Bay. The June 28, 2004 ruling outlined that the United States cannot order the indefinite detention of Guantanamo detainees without due process, and that the detainees have the right to challenge the legality of their detention in court, according to the U.S. Constitution and international law. To get more information about the Center for Constitutional Rights, visit www.ccr-ny.org. That's www.ccr-ny.org. This interview has been recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe.
Bush Team Meets, New York City, August 29th, 2004.
Did you ever want to change the course of history? Be part of something so important, so dramatic, it actually changes the course of human events?
You can when you join the millions and say
no to the lies.
No to the wars for empire.
No to the disregard for the health of our planet and the people who live on it.
No to patriarchs and the attacks on civil rights.
No to the packed judiciary and stolen elections.
No to repression of Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians.
No to the global destruction of women's rights.
No to tax cuts for the rich.
Church.
No to the religious right controlling our private lives.
No to Bush and everything he represents.
No way.
No how.
No more.
Just no. More than a million in the street saying yes.
Yes to another course.
Yes to another future.
This is the time to make history with the most massive outpouring of resistance ever.
Be in New York City August 29th and stay for the week.
Go to www.chicagonewyork.net for more information.
Nobody wants this place to be quarried. This is a national park, you know, and this place gets 40,000 visitors a year, Stanton Moor and the stones. And it's really, really well used by people, not just in, you know, the Peak District area, but all over the country and Europe, and a lot of international visitors come. And, you know, everyone's proud. This is our national park. Why are our national parks being destroyed without government intervention? Stanton Moor is one of the most archaeologically rich areas in the whole of the UK. There's like, and it's not that big, you know, because it's been eaten all the way around. It's like an apple core, just been eaten by quarries. But there's two major ley lines that run through the stone circle, and one of them comes through the site. And we're constantly getting people coming up telling us how important this site is, locals and people from all over the country, because, you know, spiritually for people, it's a really important place. The Nine Ladies Stone Circle is, you know, a really strong, positive place.
So it's,
and people don't want it to be disrupted by these quarries. The Nine Ladies Stone Circle is just one of four stone circles up there, that and the Kingstone. That's obviously the biggest and most obvious. But, you know, the quarry would be, you know, two football pitches away. Stonecliff moved in 99, and all of the trees here have got tree preservation orders on them, and they cut this big hardcore path right the way through the woods without, you know, permission. They were actually starting work.
Right.
They were doing it without the peat park's knowledge.
Yeah.
It was only because people, you know, had set up site here and alerted the peat park to it, they could get it stopped. English Heritage have been working really hard to stop these quarries reopening. Yeah.
Right.
And in fact, they say Nine Ladies Stone Circle is their kind of model stone circle in terms of environment and surroundings. That's because it's so far from roads and just the way it is, you know, up on the moorland. And so obviously it's not going to be their model stone circle anymore if there's a quarry right next to it. The 1st of June, the Peak Park is supposed to be deciding whether or not these quarries can reopen. The High Court decides that these quarries are active, even though they've not been quarried for 50 years, then Stancliffe could move in straight away and start work. Loads of projects all over the country could start reopening without, you know, without stringent kind of restrictions on them to...
It would just be a free-for-all.
It's the most fantastic place I've ever lived and probably will ever live. So come visit. It's really close by. You can just hop on the Trans Peak and get off about an hour and a half away and walk up the hill. And come visit, because it could be your last chance, because the bailiffs have been visiting. We know they're planning to evict us. They've got a climate team together. It's going to happen soon, and it's probably going to be... The leaves are out now. It's probably going to be before they fall again. So come visit.
Thank you. Thanks, Jimmy. Thank you.
Stones, you can hear the bloody machines going on the quarries. Yeah.